What do you do when you're staring death in the face? There's a tale that some of you may be familiar with about three brothers who once faced death. This is one of those fairy tales that where death is kind of brought to life as the Grim Reaper. At the beginning of this tale, these three brothers, all magicians, they're able to escape the Grim Reaper by magically making this bridge that they're able to cross over a dangerous river. So Death, who's very upset by this, and he meets the brothers on the bridge as they cross. And since he wasn't able to get them by drowning, he decides to try another way. So he offers them a prize for being so clever and avoiding them. The oldest brother, he chooses a gift. He gives them options for this prize. He chooses a gift that would make him powerful. And he thought that was going to allow him to escape death in the future. Second brother is a little bit meaner in terms of his response to death. He thought he wanted the ability to bring people back from the dead. It's kind of a way to kind of stick it to death a little bit more. I'm just going to take even more from you. The third brother, he was the wisest of the three, and he chose to ask death for something that would keep him from being seen. So he wanted to be able to avoid death by being invisible, and he was given this cloak to remain invisible. Well, even though that power did give the oldest brother an edge over all of his rivals, it was also something that his rivals really wanted. And what they wanted to get from him, and that's what they did. They got it from him while he was sleeping. Killed him, took his power. The second brother, he found as he was able to bring people back from the dead that they didn't really belong to the land of the living anymore, and it just depressed him, and finally he decided instead of bringing them to the land of the living, he would just join them in death. The third brother, this is what the writer says, but though death searched for the third brother for many years, he was never able to find him. It was only when he attained a great age that the youngest brother finally took off the cloak of invisibility, and then he greeted death as an old friend and went with him gladly, and equals they departed this life. In our world today, these are the options that we think naturally that we can face death with, right? So we either want to try and escape death, or we want to try to greet death on our terms. Now, the first of those is foolish. You can't escape death. But the latter is actually dangerous for our soul. To think that we could greet death as a friend. Both of those ideas, they involve believing that we have more control over our life than we really do. And both of them are really at the base of what's going on. They're really longing for that salvation from death. This is what we long for. And it really is a reflection of this fear that they have. Both of those approaches to death are really a reflection of an ancient longing and an ancient fear. This is what has been true since the garden. We've been longing to keep living. And we've been living with the fear of death ever since the beginning. Now, the truth is, we aren't made for death. That is not what we were intended to experience. We were made for life. But from the beginning, we wanted life on our terms. And so what we did is we really walked away from life. We walked away from God. And now what we long for is to save ourselves. In some way, we want to save our lives from this predicament that we're in. So what is the way of salvation? It is not what we naturally think. The book of Exodus is our guide to teach us how the Lord saves. And it's not intuitive. And his path of salvation is not something that we, in our fallenness, can just naturally understand, can naturally conclude. His ways are not our ways. So Exodus lays out the pattern of God's way of salvation. And that's what we're going to look at today in Exodus 13 and 14. So as the Lord puts this way of salvation on display, not only does it show us how he saves, but it also shows us how we ought to respond to him. So as we look at the way that the Lord saved Israel, we're going to see God's trustworthiness, his wisdom, his sovereignty, and his independence. And that's going to direct us to trust in him alone for this salvation. So you could turn to Exodus 13. It's on page, again, 52, there in the Bible, there in the pew. And we're going to first look at the Lord's trustworthiness in salvation, and we're starting in verse 17. So back in Exodus 13 and verses 5 and 11, the Lord mentioned this goal that he had to bring his people into the land that he'd promised their forefathers to give them. This is the land of the Canaanites, he says. Now, the most direct route to that land was the way of the sea, or the Via Maris, as it's pronounced in Latin, although that's probably not how you pronounce it. Here, it's called the way of the land of the Philistines. That would have been the shortest route to the promised land, but it's not the way that the Lord took his people. And he gives his reasoning for doing that in verse 17. Even though it was near, that is, the shortest route, the Lord didn't want to take them in that direction. He says, lest the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. And that's not saying that God couldn't have conquered the Philistines just like he was conquering the Egyptians. But God had more than simply the promised land in mind when he rescued his people. There was a greater purpose for delivering them from their slavery to Egypt. They were delivered from serving Pharaoh in order to serve the Lord. And God had even given Moses this sign. You remember back in chapter 3 of Exodus when Moses is really meeting the Lord. The Lord gave him a sign that was supposed to confirm that he was commissioned by God to bring them out of Israel. The sign was, you're going to worship me on this mountain when you bring the people out. So the Lord wasn't just trying to bring them to the promised land. He was doing something more. He didn't need to plow through every people group to get them to the promised land. And then there's this also that's true. The Philistines weren't included in God's prophecy in Genesis 15. So God told Abraham, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to give you this land. I'm going to punish the people that are there. But the Philistines, they seem to be, this group of Philistines seems to be new to the area. God was going to give them more time. It was the Canaanites who had exhausted God's patience. They had lived over 400 years rebelling, sinning against him. Those were the ones that the Lord was going to address. So now beyond that, this what he says here is that if Israel was going to be confronted with war this quickly, they were going to turn tail and run back to Egypt. They were not ready to face war. We see that reflex even in this passage. They are not ready to face anything. So they would have to fight. They would have to do that when they got to the land, but they weren't ready. So the Lord led the people by the way of the wilderness toward the Red Sea. Now, despite what people may sound like when they talk about the places in Exodus here, we have no idea where this was. I mean, I guess you could say we have an idea in the general area, but we don't know where these places are. We don't even know where the Red Sea is here, because this specific name in Hebrew is not the Red Sea. So some people think that this was one of those lakes east of Egypt that's now dried up. Other people believe it's the Gulf of Suez that really extends from the Red Sea. You could call that the Red Sea. The only confirmed location of this body of water, Yam Suf in Hebrew, is the Gulf of Aqaba, which is just south of Israel. And it's an extension of the Red Sea, which is what I think is the best actual chance for this particular reference. We can talk afterwards if you want to know more about that. But the point is that the names that are given here don't function the same for us as they did the original audience. The original audience understood these place names. They understood what it was pointing to. For us, what it does is it says that Moses is not writing something that's legendary. This is historical. He's pinpointing exactly their route. He's pinpointing exactly where they go. This is not meant to be some legendary fairy tale. This is supposed to be a historical description of what happened. And Moses is inspired to tell us the significance of it. So that's why he relates it the way that he does. So they left on a clear route. They were going on an actual road, a path that many people had traveled before. So Dwayne Garrett refers to this as the Darb El Hag. I don't know exactly, but that's a specific route in this area. And they didn't go out haphazardly. They weren't just like running away like a mad dash of a crowd of people. It says in verse 18, the people of Israel went up out of the land of Egypt equipped for battle. That last phrase, equipped for battle, it's a phrase that's just one word in Hebrew. And it comes from the Hebrew word for the number 5. So it doesn't imply any weaponry. It doesn't mean that they were all carrying, you know, swords, that they were equipped in that way. One of the possibilities for what this is talking about is that this was a division of 5 different groups. It is how armies would go, but it could be that they were going out with a vanguard in the front, then they had a central group, and then they had a group in the back, the rear guard, and then they had 2 flanking groups on the sides. And what that would have done is that it would have protected the vulnerable in the center. So that at least explains. But even if that's not exactly what this is describing, it is describing an orderly movement. So this is an orderly exodus. The Lord is taking them very, very organized in an organized way out of Egypt. He's taking great care in how he directs them. He's not just taking them in any path. He's taking them down a specific route. That should have been something that they would have looked at and said, we can trust God. He has a plan. He's going in this specific way. We can also see God's trustworthiness in the testimony of Joseph, which you see in verse 19. So as early as Abraham, in Genesis, you see the patriarchs, they want to be buried in the promised land. They have this goal. They believed that their ancestors would possess the land. That's what God promised. And so by faith, they were securing these burial places. So when Jacob was dying, he's there in Egypt. He tells his sons to bury him in the promised land. And you remember that Egyptian processional, that funeral procession to the land? This grand thing that the Canaanites were surprised at. Well, Joseph could have easily, as important as he was in Egypt, he could have easily required that same thing. But that's not what he did. This is what he tells his brothers. God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones with you from here. What he's doing is he's vocalizing his faith in God's promise that Jacob's family is going to return to the land. They're going to possess that land. And so he was so sure of that, that instead of saying, when I die, you need to take me to the promised land. He said, when I die, you need to have my bones such that you can take them with you when you go. He wanted to be buried in the promised land, but he was absolutely confident that would happen when God took his people and brought them back to the land. So he knew God's way of salvation was trustworthy. Now, very often I imagine that people think that God's ways are mysterious. It's true. God's ways are not our ways, and it's true that the secret things belong to the Lord, but the things that are revealed belong to us. And so when God's way is revealed, it's clear. And that's what you see with God's way of salvation for Israel. He takes the lead. He makes his directions very clear. How did he do that? This pillar of cloud and a pillar of fire. Now, it's not clear what that looked like. To me, based on what other people have said, it seems best when they describe it as one pillar, as though it's this fiery pillar that's surrounded by a cloud of smoke. So in the light of the sun, all you'd see was the smoke. And then at night, you see that blazing fire shine through. It does seem to be one pillar. The point here is that God is very clearly leading them in the direction they should go. There's no question about what God's will was. And so I'd like how Alec Motier puts it. He describes the significance of this. He says, the fundamental truth that we need to take note of in all of this is that for the Israelites, guidance was made easy and unmissable. Every move in whatever direction, every stop and start, every turn of the pathway was by the will of God. When it comes to the way of salvation, God is very clear, and he's just as clear for us today. So Jesus explained, both in his life and through his apostles, the way of salvation begins by faith in him. So those who would be saved must answer the question he posed to his disciples correctly. Who do you say that I am? Salvation begins with those who believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And we believe that in spite of the fact that the King of the world was crucified by the Romans. We believe that he was crucified as a sacrifice for our sin, and that he was raised, and that he's at the right hand of the Father now. He's in charge. He's king. So when we trust in Jesus, we're considered righteous, and we're accepted by God right then. We are saved. But the way of salvation continues for us. We keep following Christ. We grow in this sanctification. And here's where Christians begin to doubt that our salvation is clear, our way of salvation is clear. Right? We have so many questions about what we should do, how we should live. The truth is, God doesn't hide the way of salvation from us. We don't have to meditate in some corner, waiting for some secret impulse to guide us. God has made the way of salvation clear. He has made the way that we should go clear, even now. What is God's will for your life? Paul answers that question in 1 Thessalonians 4:3. He says, this is the will of God, your sanctification. How does God sanctify us? By his Spirit, by his word, by his people. That's what it says in Ephesians 4. Within that path of salvation, you know, we have many choices. But our goal in those choices is not to be the best. You understand that? The best with our money, the best with our education, the best with our career, to be parents of the best children, that's not our goal. Our goal in each and every choice that we make is that we would be like Christ. That's why Paul prayed the way that he did in Philippians chapter 1 for these believers. He prayed that as we approach Christ-likeness in love, it is that love that gives us the knowledge and discernment to actually make choices, to figure out what's best. What's best is not necessarily being the greatest economist or the greatest parent. Some of us are better than others. That's just the facts. What's best is loving as Christ loves. And he has made the path of love very clear. So the path is clear. Just as the Israelites found God's way very clear before them, and thus trustworthy, so should we. We can be confident that just like with Israel, God's not going to take us down a path that is too much for us. That's what he says in 1 Corinthians 10:13. His way is clear. It is so clear. It is just as clear as the pillar of cloud and fire. That we should be able to be just like Joseph. We should be able to be laid to rest with perfect assurance that God is going to keep his promises. He is trustworthy. And he's also wise. That's what we see next. The Lord's wisdom in salvation. And we see that in chapter 14 at the very beginning. Now, to us, the way of salvation may seem foolish, right? We may look at it and we say, that doesn't make sense. But God has reasons why he accomplished salvation the way that he has. One of those reasons is that he accomplishes salvation the way he does so as to completely defeat his enemy. An even greater reason is that he's done everything he has the way that he has for his glory. That's what we see here with Israel. So at the beginning of chapter 14, at this point, Moses turns off from the path that he's been on. This major route he seems to head south of. And instead of going that normal route, he goes along and ends up going along the sea. The Lord then explains his plan in verse 3. Pharaoh is supposed to see them turn off from the main route, into the wilderness, think that they've gotten confused. I mean, they're traveling in this clear direction, and then they turn off of it. It looks like they're wandering around aimlessly. And that is precisely what the Lord wanted so that he would accomplish what he says in verse 4. And he does that specifically, he says, by strengthening Pharaoh's heart. So he renewed Pharaoh's resolve so that he would lead, he would chase after Israel. And in this way, he says, the Lord would get glory over Pharaoh and all his host. And how that is the way that the Egyptians would know that he is the Lord. That word for host, it's a word you could translate strength. It means military here in this context, but you can see this is Pharaoh's power. This is Pharaoh's glory. And it's going to be up against the Lord's glory. And it's going to pale in comparison. So that's God's glory, or that's God's goal in salvation, to display his glory. And he displays this amazing, glorious wisdom here. Pharaoh never repented of his treatment of Israel. That is not what happened when he let them go. The only reason why he let the Israelites go was because the Lord didn't protect his heart from the impact of that last plague. It wilted. It was crushed under the weight of that last plague when he lost his firstborn and the firstborn of his people. So Pharaoh's desires didn't change in that moment. What we see from Pharaoh here is the kind of enemy who is never going to be satisfied. It reminds me of the end of the movie Hook, you know, where Peter Pan, played by Robin Williams, is fighting Dustin Hoffman's, you know, Captain Hook. And he reaches this point where Peter Pan is done. He says, you know what? I don't want to keep fighting. I don't need to fight anymore. He's just going to take his kids back with him safely away. But Captain Hook is not done. And so he screams down to Peter. He says, I swear to you, wherever you go, wherever you are, I vow there will always be daggers buried in notes signed James Hook. They will be flung in the doors of your children's children's children. The only way for him to end that battle was the end of Captain Hook. That was the only way it was going to actually end. That's the kind of enemy Pharaoh is. He was an enemy to the end. The only true freedom from that kind of an enemy is their complete defeat. Escape wasn't enough. So in God's wisdom, he drew Pharaoh out to fight him in one last battle. He was, as one person put it, he was like this master chess player, a grandmaster, who set Pharaoh up perfectly to walk right into his checkmate. Now, there's even greater wisdom here because through this victory, arguably against the greatest power at the time, the Lord was going to demonstrate who really was King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He was going to put that beyond doubt that he was the superior ruler. So his victory was going to show just how great he was. And it was going to give the final answer to that question that Pharaoh had back in chapter 5. Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice? When the Lord defeated Pharaoh, at this battle, every Egyptian would know who the Lord was. So I think it's easy for people to wonder, why does God do the things that he does? Why does he save us the way that he does? You know, why does Jesus have to die? Why does salvation have to go through such a horrific thing? The truth is that our salvation in Christ really puts on display God's wisdom. Because it's only through Christ's death and resurrection that sin and death would finally and decisively be defeated. See, sin is the kind of enemy that can only be defeated by death. Sin had power over us. So we remember by our connection to Adam, the first man, our representative, we are separated from God by his sin. And we're all under the power of sin. So when Jesus entered this world, also as our representative, he wasn't under the power of sin. And he did what our first representative didn't do. He obeyed. So he didn't deserve this curse that belongs to the sin-ruled world. And he embraced that curse, and by doing that, he robbed sin of its power. So by dying when he didn't deserve to die, he provided that substitute payment for sinners like us. He provided the freedom from our slavery to sin. So the only way for us to truly be free was for sin to die. Jesus took our sin, the sin of everyone who believes in him, on the cross with him. At the cross, our greatest enemy was finally and fully defeated. Do you believe that? This is what displays God's glory. God's glory. We can't take credit for our salvation. We're going to see that even more here in a little bit, but God's wisdom in saving us is seen through what he does with Israel. It shows everyone how great he is. It shows everyone how he can defeat sin and how he gets the glory for it. It shows how great he is. And we catch a glimpse of that greatness as we see his sovereignty in verses 5 through 9. So let's look at the Lord's sovereignty and salvation. The Lord told us what was going to happen, and then look at what happens, exactly what he said. Verse 5 kind of takes the camera, as it were, and pans to Pharaoh and his officials. And they receive word about this, what's happening with Israel. It's likely that they had some scouts out there in the wilderness and that were able to say, this is what's happening, this is what's going down. And they told Pharaoh that Israel was running off. Now, what he means by fled isn't that they had somehow like tricked Pharaoh and run away in the night. Pharaoh had sent them off, but they're now getting far and far away. So that's what kind of provokes Pharaoh and his officials to change their minds. It's not that he thought, well, you know, the right thing to do was to let them go, and now I'm not sure that was the right thing to do. He didn't think that was the right thing to do. He just thought that was his only option. Now that he's starting to think about things, he doesn't think it maybe is his only option anymore. So he says what's bothering him. He says, what is this we've done? That we have let Israel go from serving us. He's saying, what in the world were we thinking? I mean, we had a great thing going. We had free labor. Now we're going to have to do all this stuff ourselves. So he mobilizes this really quick response team. The text really says he made ready his chariot and took his people with them. And it's true, his people would be the army, the military there. But it seems like he's pitting God's people against his people. And so Pharaoh takes the speedy chariot. His people are doing the same thing. It says he took 600 chosen chariots. That's a lot of military vehicles. And then it says that the next phrase is less clear. I'm inclined to agree with Desmond Alexander that it should be translated every chariot Egyptian. Again, I think what he's doing is he's pitting the Israelites against the Egyptians. He's making that clear. So all the people that were on these chariots were Egyptians. And then his final phrase, with officers over all of them, normally a chariot had a driver and an archer. It seems like there was one more. They had some of his best soldiers on the back of those chariots. So verse 8 confirms what the Lord promised. He strengthened Pharaoh's resolve so that he would have the courage to face the Lord in this final battle. And that's pretty amazing, right? That God gives his enemy the courage to face him. But that's exactly what would be necessary. I mean, we've seen what just happened. These amazing powers over all the so-called gods of Egypt. The Lord's demonstrated his omnipotence. And so now we have this crazy king chasing toward this omnipotent creator. I mean, this is sheer lunacy. How is he going to beat this God? He's already been defeated once, pretty much. So the reality is, this is what his heart wanted. This is what he really wanted. The Lord is just strengthening his heart so that he will stay the course to the end, so that he'll really chase after what he really wants. And you get a taste of the bitterness going on in his mind, this lunatic traveling and chasing after them. It says he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. The Hebrew reads that the sons of Israel were going out with hand raised. They were defiantly leaving Egypt. They knew that they had won. And that ticked him off. He was not happy. I'm sure as he's chasing after him, he's imagining the horror that would come over their face when they saw him. This delusional king was hateful towards this group of people. And yet, what was he doing? He's only doing what the Lord had predestined to take place. He's doing exactly what the Lord had planned. Even though he's in this mad rush, he's only doing what God had planned for him to do. You know, we talk about being out of control. There's a sense in which, you know, it means we're not really in control of our desires. Our desires are taking control of us. But crazy thing, this guy is out of control, and yet he's completely under God's control. That's how salvation works. Our enemies would think that they're in the driver's seat. And they are truly making their own decisions. We want to be clear about that. So God's hardening or strengthening of Pharaoh's heart, strengthening his resolve, in no way made Pharaoh a puppet. That's what's so amazing about his sovereignty. His enemies can mean what they're doing for evil. And at the same time, the Lord can mean the very same things for his good. And that's what we see here. And that's what we see with our salvation. Right, you remember how Jesus told his disciples what was going to happen before he actually arrived in Jerusalem? At least three times in Matthew, he tells them, look, I'm going to be executed, arrested and executed, and then I'm going to rise on the third day. And you remember what Pilate did when he was interviewing him in the book of John. He tries to set Jesus straight. Remember how Jesus set him straight. Pilate told Jesus, do you know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you? And Jesus says, you would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above. So Jesus knew in that moment that everything that was happening to him was exactly as his disciples would later say. It was whatever God's hand and plan had predestined to take place. So again, we see the trustworthiness of God. God is sovereign. He is wise. He is trustworthy. And he's also independent when he saves us. We see the Lord's independence in salvation in verses 10 through 14. The way that the Lord saves does not involve our cooperation. This is what he makes very clearly. Very clear to Israel. And then through Israel to us. At verse 10, we have this change in perspective. So we've been looking at things through Pharaoh's eyes. Now we're going to look at things through Israel's eyes. So we have this repetition. We already knew that Pharaoh had overtaken them. Now we're looking at that from Israel's vantage point. They look up, they see something they were not expecting. Here comes this crazy-eyed former slave owner charging toward them with 600 fully armed chariots. You can understand why it says they feared greatly and why they cried out to the Lord. But here's the thing. They cry out to the Lord like some people do today when they say, God, help us. Right? This is not them thinking the Lord can help them. That's very clear from what they go on to say. This is like somebody in their desperate hour giving this prayer, God, help us, when they don't really think anything can happen. Listen to what they say to Moses. They say, I'm going to look at it over here. They say, is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you've taken us away to die in the wilderness? It's actually a pretty funny bit of sarcasm, given the fact that they were leaving Egypt. You know, the way that's worded, it sounds like, are you telling me that there were absolutely no graves in Egypt? That's obviously not true. I mean, Egypt is kind of the capital of graves, right? They have three or four very, very big graves. That's what the pyramids are. They're graves. They're saying, oh, are you telling me there weren't any graves in Egypt? I mean, the pyramids were right there. There were plenty of graves in Egypt. Why'd you take us out here to die? And then they say, they kind of sound exactly like Pharaoh. It's like they're agreeing with Pharaoh at this point. What is this, you know, Pharaoh said, what is this we have done that we have let Israel go from serving us? And here they're saying, what have you done to us in bringing us out of Egypt? Is this not what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. They're saying, we wanted to stay. We didn't want to leave. We agree with Pharaoh. You should have never done that. We should not be here. This was a mistake. It would be better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. It is comical and sad. And it's the kind of thing we see repeatedly in the wilderness. They have a short memory. There's nobody saying, hold on, guys, didn't we just see God rescue us? I mean, everybody's like, no, we're dead. Gig's up. We have no hope. So you can see how or where this is headed in the future. This is the attitude of the people. Short memories. Moses knew better, though, and he told them, fear not, stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. He's saying, you guys don't actually have to be afraid. In fact, you don't have to do anything. Just stand still, watch what the Lord is going to do for you. And he adds, for the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. This is their curtain call. They are out of your lives after this. You're never going to see these Egyptians again in your life. And then the Hebrew reads a little bit more abruptly. The Lord will fight for you, but you be quiet. It's almost like Moses has lost his patience at this point. Look, the Lord's going to take care of this. You just need to stop. Don't do anything. God's got this. You just sit there. That's how our salvation works. That's true that later on, the Lord's going to use people in other situations. There's going to be armies that fight, and the Lord enables them to fight. Not here. This is their defining moment. This is Old Testament salvation. The Exodus is that act whereby God makes Israel his people. And he does not want their hands in it at all. It's his salvation. He gets the credit for it. He does it independently, without cooperation. If they had cooperated, imagine what they'd have thought. If they'd have helped. Hey, didn't we kind of help? We kind of got ourselves out of this mess. They'd been able to take some credit for it. When God delivers his people, nobody but him gets the credit. That's the paradigm for future deliverance. And that's what's unique about Christianity from all the other religions in the world. Every other religion in the world has us helping ourselves get out of a jam. Not Christianity. That's not what faith is, by the way. Faith is not our cooperation, our playing a part in our salvation. It's our response to our salvation. So when you look at what's necessary to transform a life, what's necessary to escape the clutches of sin, you should be just as pessimistic as these Israelites if you look to yourself. Because you can't do it. You cannot escape your sin. Only God can take you out of that. Only by his power can he make you acceptable to him. God's salvation is by his power alone. That's not to say that he doesn't require us to respond to it, but even that is part of his grace. According to Ephesians 2:8, our entire salvation by grace through faith is a gift of God. So when we believe the good news, and what we believe actually is that Jesus saved us. That's what we believe. We don't believe Jesus made salvation possible. We believe he saved us. What we believe is that he did it. It's not that our faith saves in the sense that it accomplishes anything in salvation. Right? Faith is not part of our salvation. It's the point at which a change occurs. It's where we begin to be those who actually benefit from salvation. It doesn't do it. It doesn't save. You do not save yourself in any way, shape, or form. Christ and Christ alone is the object of our faith. He's accomplished an eternal redemption. He sprinkles our heart with his blood. So God is entirely independent when he saves us. So who then do you look to for hope? In those difficult moments, when you don't know what to do you look to yourself? No. You look to God. How do you look to God? You trust him. You know that he's wise. You know that he's sovereign. You know that he is going to save you. He has saved you. He is saving you. He will save you. You can have confidence in that. We walk his path. We walk it on his terms. He knows what's best. And we can have that confidence even as we face death. Think about the difference between Israel and Joseph. They're both facing death. Right? Israel faces death. They cry out to God, not in any way actually trusting in him. They panic. They actually found greater comfort in their old master than in God. Right? They said it would have been better to keep serving Pharaoh than to leave Egypt to serve God. Better just be with our old master. Why did they say that? Well, because of what they saw as their ultimate good. Staying alive. And we struggle with the same thing today. You know, we have our own versions of what is best. And that's why we question what happens in those twists and turns. Because that path that we're taking doesn't look like what we want it to look like. As long as we feel like we're in control, we're good. It's in those moments where we realize we're not in control, that's when we panic, that's when we have trouble, that's when anxiety rushes in. Then look at Joseph. Joseph is able to face death, not on his own terms, but trusting God. He could rest in God's promises, even as he faced death. He was at peace. Even if he should die, he knew that that was exactly what the Lord had for him. He was resting in God. Micah and McKenna they have a summer reading book that it's Tuesdays with Maury. So, you know, I try to follow what they're reading at times. And so I put this on my Audible playlist, started reading it or listening to it rather. It's about this university professor who's dying and his former student basically observes him as he dies and records it. So this book's very much about how you face death. And I'm only midway through, but I've come across this key statement. Maury says, once you learn how to die, you learn how to live. I think there's some truth in that, right? Because death has this way of kind of showing us what was really important. When you come to the end, you start to think about, well, what really was important with my life? Reevaluate your priorities. Problem is, Maury is just like that younger brother in the story I began with. He's trying to come to death on his own terms. Right? He's trying not to delay it. He's accepted that, but he's trying to understand death in a way that allows him to be the most satisfied with his life. He's trying to greet death as an old friend. That's the way our Brave New World works, right? That's the way we desensitize ourselves to death. Death is a horror. It should scare us. But we kind of find ways to ease ourselves into it, as Maury was doing. The peace that people find sometimes as they're facing death is actually very ignorant. Because it doesn't look at death like it really is. It's a punishment. And on the other side of that punishment is not peace. It's judgment. So we only learn how to live by learning how to die when that death is to ourselves, to our ideas as to what is best. Living for what you think is best is exactly what landed us in this problem in the first place. So when we see the wisdom and the sovereignty of God's salvation, salvation through death, that's when we can understand how to live. We have to come to an end to ourselves. We who've been enslaved by this sin, we have to die. And trust God then with our life, whatever he wants to do with it. Instead of trying to save yourself, you trust God to save you. He knows what he's doing. He's in charge. He will save you. You can't save yourself. Join me in prayer. Father, there are many things in this world that are disturbing, that are difficult, that can make us feel like, well, actually it just makes us see reality, that we're not in control. And it can be very scary. It can cause a lot of anxiety. It can cause depression and anger and frustration as we try to maintain some control over it. Help us to recognize what you're doing. Not that you would show us exactly what you're doing in each and every circumstance, but that you would reveal to us, just as you have through Israel, that you are in charge. That you know what is best. That your ways are better than our ways. That we can trust you when you tell us the way that we should approach life, that we should approach it that way. And though we long for more, we long for the secret things that belong to you, grant us the grace to accept what you give and to pursue that, to pursue a love like Christ, that we would abound in love. And in doing so, abound in knowledge and discernment, so that we would know what is truly best, not what's necessarily going to give us what we might think is our best. But what is really best? Your salvation, your sanctifying work, even now. You have justified us. Our salvation is secure, and you are now saving us, sanctifying us. And one day you will glorify us. So on our path towards that glory, a glory that will be yours, grant us the love that gives you glory. That fruit of righteousness that flows out of our salvation. That flows out of our trusting you. Because we can trust you. We may not know what's going to happen, but we know. We know that you've got this. We know that you know what's best. We're confident that you're going to bring us through to the end. So we do ask for mercy, for your grace to believe that. Even that is not in our power. Spirit has to work that salvation out in us. So we're going to take these steps of faith, wholly relying on him. And we do pray for anyone here who does think that they can clean themselves up, who does think that they can make themselves better, improve their situation, make life the way that it's supposed to be. Anyone who's resting in themselves, trusting themselves, they would recognize how dangerous that is, how false that is. They would give up trusting themselves, and trust instead in the Almighty God, in you who created them, who sustains them, the one who saves everyone who trusts in him. Cause them to see that, to see Christ, to believe that he died for them. Even now, they would believe that. Then grant us the grace to live in light of that. Amen.